G'day, folks, and welcome. I'm Chris Faber.
And I'm TJ Steadman.
And you're listening to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, coming to you from sunny Western Australia.
G'day, folks, and welcome back to another episode of the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, the show that tackles your questions about the biblical giants. Last week, we looked at the final words that God speaks to Noah before the flood begins, and that was quite ominous. This week, we're going to ramp up the suspense. It's all about action. Looming threat of what is about to happen next.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Chris. We will not hear another word from God spoken to Noah until the flood has ended. To quote Gandalf the White, understand this, things are now in motion that cannot be undone.
I ride from Minas Tirith. Great scene, great scene. So basically the fate of the human race rests with Noah at this point.
Yeah, it'd be fair to say that he has the weight of the world on his shoulders, caught in the middle between the Nephilim and the destroying angels sent to wipe them out, and charged with the responsibility of taking care of all that God has entrusted to him. And that's a carefully chosen turn of phrase there, as we shall see. So our reading for today is from Genesis 7, verses 5 to 9. We're getting into the exciting stuff now. Here's the translation. And Noah did all that the Lord commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the flood waters came on the earth. And Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives entered the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Pairs of clean and unclean animals, of birds and of all creatures that move along the ground, male and female, came to Noah and entered the ark as God had commanded Noah.
I don't know about you, Tim, but the way I picture this in my mind, it was probably very different how it would played out in real life, because when people talk about this, they sort of, you know, give this idea that it was all very orderly and neat and peaceful, and there's Noah just rounding up the animals gently and canning them, and everyone's, you know, pretty relaxed about the whole thing. And Noah isn't a priest or, a sea captain or something. He's a shepherd. And there might be storm clouds in the background or something like that, but there's no great hurry. What do you think it actually looked like, Tim?
Absolute shambles, mate. Chaos on a stick would have been absolutely crazy, because the way it's written here, it looks very much like, even though they had 7 days to prepare from the time that God gave his final notice of intent, this is all happening at the last minute. The waters of the flood have arrived. And if you've been listening to this podcast lately, you know what I mean by that. God has let loose an overwhelming force of destruction. There's never been anything like this. Just look at the urgency expressed in verse 7. Everyone's in a hurry to get on the ark because the procession of the 7 destroying angels is happening. They have arrived and they're coming this way, and nothing can stand before them. So you've got people rushing around trying to get stuff done at the last minute. You've got animals here, there and everywhere, and the whole atmosphere is one of absolute chaos. And the story doesn't tell us anything about what's going on outside of this immediate context. Think about what's happening in the world around Noah. Everybody was just going about their business until suddenly this destruction comes upon them. Remember what Jesus said. Matthew 24, from verse 36. But about that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken and the other left. Therefore keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. And the way that looked, if we could have been there to see it with our own eyes, I would imagine is something like a tidal wave of violence as people fled from the judgment of God and invaded other lands in order to try and escape. And of course you can't invade someone else's land without receiving a hostile reaction. And we have to remember that these are not ordinary human armies doing battle. We're talking about the Nephilim. These are giants. This would have been a battle of colossal proportions, and it's everywhere. And everyone's involved whether they like it or not. So these destroying angels have moved in, and they're wreaking havoc wherever they go, with the Nephilim fleeing before them like rats from a burning building. And the destroyers are approaching them from all sides, rounding them up and causing conflict between different tribes and nations, forcing them to destroy themselves, and whatever is left, they're going to destroy personally.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely epic. It's like something out of Lord of the Rings or Star Wars or something for sure. But is that just something in your imagination, Tim, or have other people seen it this way too?
Well, there is some history of interpretation along these lines, and that's what we're going to look at next week. So I won't spend too much time on it now, but yeah, it is a legitimate way of reading this text. And it was popular in the Second Temple period, and we need to keep in mind that's the immediate context in which the New Testament was written. So if we look closely, we're going to find allusions to this in the New Testament scriptures, but that's for later. Now, I want to look a bit more closely at the text we have in front of us. Noah did all that Yahweh commanded him. Fairly straightforward stuff here, but I want to talk about the word translated as commanded.
Okay, so what's going on there?
Well, I mentioned earlier that God had entrusted certain things to Noah, and that's where this is tracking. We've got the idea presented here that God had entrusted these things into Noah's care and put him in charge of them. So this is definitely a kind of stewardship, and that implies a relationship of trust, which is primarily built on Noah's obedience earlier. So this becomes a familiar refrain. Noah did all that the Lord had commanded him, and we're going to keep hearing it until it sinks in. This is what God expects from us. We've already seen the same terminology before, but I didn't spend any time on it. The first three times we get it, it's addressed to Adam. This is Genesis 2, verses 16 to 17. And the Lord God commanded the man, "You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat from it, you will certainly die." Then we have it in Genesis 3:11. And he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from?" And then Genesis 3:17, to Adam he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat food from it all the days of your life." So as I mentioned, there are three times where you see that idea of the commandment in which God has entrusted something to the care of the person in question, and the third time, the consequence of failure is a curse. Now it's Noah's turn, and we're going to see it used four times. Genesis 6:22, Noah did everything just as God commanded him. Genesis 7:5, and Noah did all that the Lord commanded him. Genesis 7:9, male and female came to Noah and entered the ark as God had commanded Noah. And Genesis 7:16, the animals going in were male and female of every living thing as God had commanded Noah. Then the Lord shut him in. And not surprisingly, we won't see that language again until we start talking about Abraham. But you can see why I keep calling Noah the new and better Adam. And again, I'm doing that with the understanding that what we're seeing in the life of Noah is a prefigurement of Christ.
I love the way that biblical authors will use a particular word to draw you back to an idea that they've established earlier. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Once you see these things in the text, the theology just builds itself. It's written into the very language of Scripture. Notice that the language of commandment occurs twice in our reading today, in verses 5 and 9, and the second time it says that the animals came to Noah and entered the ark as God had commanded Noah. The animals are coming because God said they would to Noah. In this, we can see that it's a mutual participation of both God and Noah that ensures the security of the animals. Noah was instructed to bring them into the ark, but the animals came because God had told Noah that he would have to get them on board. This is a cooperative effort, and the language of commandment here is supposed to reflect that relationship of faithfulness and participation in the work. It's not just a case of God saying, "I'm giving you an instruction and I expect you to do it on your own." So I thought that was interesting because it should have ramifications for the way that we approach participation in the work of God in our day-to-day situation. So the next thing we have in the text is this unusual statement about Noah's age, and it says that he was 600 years old at this time.
Yeah, why is that there?
Now, I've already gone to some lengths to unpack the peculiarities of genealogies when we were going through season 5 of the podcast. We have to remember that this flood story isn't something that comes after the genealogy, but rather something that is interrupting it. So this is a piece of that genealogy specifically placed in this location in the text for literary reasons, because it forms part of this poetic structure as a whole. And it also serves as a chronological marker on our way toward the establishment of the original Jewish temple, which was built by Solomon. If that doesn't make any sense to you, then I'd suggest you go back through season 5 of the podcast to get a bit of an idea of where that's going. So, yeah, that's why that's there. So it forms a literary connection between the cosmic temple that God dedicated in the creation week, the temple that Noah is dedicating right now, and the temple that would later be dedicated by Solomon. Of course, Solomon, in his typical style, didn't just devote a week to dedicating it, but a second week as well. That's from 1 Kings chapter 8.
Fair enough, and that really was quite an involved discussion, I recall, so I can understand why you wouldn't want to try and recap over all of that stuff here. It's probably just easier to go back and listen to those early episodes to try and get a handle on it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and another thing to keep in mind about a verse like that is that it functions in very much the same way as we see in other ancient Near Eastern texts, such as the Sumerian King List, where the flood event forms a major chronological marker. Right, so if you remember, we talked about the King List before. I'll give you a little quote. In Shurupak, Ubaratutu became king. He ruled for 18,600 years. One king, he ruled for 18,600 years in five cities, eight kings. They ruled for 241,200 years. Then the flood swept over. After the flood had swept over and the kingship had descended from heaven, the kingship was in Kish. In Kish, Ishur became king. He ruled for 1,200 years. I won't be going over the peculiarities of the king list again here, but in whatever ancient text you're reading, you will find that the establishment of a new order follows the flood event. That's really the point. The Bible is no different. We now live in a new world, and certainly that's the way it was understood by the authors of the New Testament, especially St. Peter. So we should be keeping that in mind when we read Revelation as well. Remember, I was saying at the start of this season that we're going to see a lot of stuff here that's in keeping with Jewish eschatology. Why do you think Jesus goes back to Noah when he starts talking about the end of the age? It's because he understands that the flood story is instrumental in providing a picture of Jewish eschatological expectation. So this is the definitive point at which the old world passes away and the new world is about to be brought into being. That doesn't just mean that all the buildings and stuff that were there before have to be rebuilt. We're talking about the re-establishment of cosmic order in the heavens and on the earth. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Genesis 7, verse 7. And Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives entered the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Okay, so now we're really getting into the action. The author's very careful to keep reminding us who's getting on board here. The language is very consistent and the repetition never varies. It's always Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives. No more, no less.
It's almost like that's important or something.
And that is important because, as I mentioned last week, you got a lot of people trying to find explanations for why the Nephilim appear again after the flood. And one of those theories is the idea that somebody stowed away on board the ark or perhaps was hanging on outside the boat. And there are Jewish traditions to that effect, but that's the kind of thing you have to do with the information you have available at the time, I suppose. Certainly in the time when the New Testament was being written, nobody was entertaining that kind of idea. I should also point out those are like medieval period interpretations, so they come a very long time after the context of writing. But anyway, enough of that. We finally got some action in this text, so let's make the most of it. They entered the ark to escape the waters of the flood. When you think about it, it really does have that dramatic sense of a narrow escape from these fearsome powers. But how close was it? I want to tell you now, it's nothing like the laconic stroll up the gangplank depicted in your Sunday school coloring books. Let's read it closely. In Hebrew, we have Mipanei Mei Hamabul. Your translations will have something like, because of the waters of the flood, or to escape from the waters of the flood. And given what we've already unpacked about the terminology here, especially as we were reading Psalm 29 last season, I think it'd be fair to read this as from the face of the divine procession. That puts Noah and his family very close to the action. We are no longer saying, take your time, you've got a week to get away. We are talking the narrowest of escapes here. This is skin of the teeth kind of stuff. They literally see the faces of these destroying angels. You see that and live, you are in rare company, my friend.
Yeah, so how did they survive?
Because Noah made atonement for them. Noah gave them the mark of faithfulness to Yahweh. He coated the ark inside and out, the house, the wall, and the contents thereof with pitch. We're going to talk more about this idea of atonement as we get into a discussion of the Exodus in an episode coming up soon. Meanwhile, outside, the mark of Cain was a death sentence. You receive one mark and you live. You receive the other mark and you die. Tell me you're not thinking about the book of Revelation right now. But what you should be thinking is the book of Ezekiel, chapter 9, which probably inspired both this story and the Revelation. Seven destroying angels, seven executioners, the seven spirits of God. Don't tell me that God isn't to be feared. And I can hear people pushing back on that idea already. No, you don't understand. The sevenfold spirit of God, I'll tell you what it is. It's a fabrication. It's a convenient misunderstanding which is maintained in order to cover up the fact that people just don't know what they're talking about. If you say it loud enough and often enough, it becomes tradition. Come on, let's look at the scripture. Revelation chapter 1, verses 4 to 5. John, to the seven churches in the province of Asia, grace and peace to you from him who is and who was and who is to come, and from the seven spirits before his throne, and from Jesus Christ, who is the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead, and the ruler of the kings of the earth. Now, the book of Revelation says the seven spirits of God, not the sevenfold spirit. It's the seven spirits before the throne of God, not the seven spirits who are attributes of God. And everybody thinks that comes from Isaiah. So I've called Isaiah to the stand here to testify before us. This is what he had to say. Isaiah 11, verses 2 to 3. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of might, the Spirit of the knowledge and fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. That's not a sevenfold spirit. In fact, if you do your counting properly, what we have is three pairs of attributes that belong to the same Spirit. There is no plural language anywhere in that passage. They don't even add up to seven. This is a description of the one Holy Spirit expressed in three doublets. There's absolutely no connection between Isaiah 11 and Revelation chapter 1. They're not talking about the same thing. Again, if you want to make parallels, you're going to have to look in Ezekiel chapter 9 and here in the flood story. That's where you'll get your seven spirits of God. I know that's a bit of a hot take coming from me because most people don't want to take the time to really study that logically. But this is what people do when they're studying Revelation. They see something they've never heard of before. They're literally scouring the Bible to find anything that might possibly line up with it. And if you haven't got room in your worldview for a situation where God uses multiple spiritual entities to accomplish his purposes, this is where you end up. You have to turn those seven spirits into one and then try to find some kind of justification for it, even if it means hoping that people don't realize that you can't count.
Geez, Tim, don't hold back or anything.
Yeah, I just get a bit ticked off when I see people making stuff up and teaching it because it feels nicer to have some kind of a comforting message that's completely made of rubbish instead of helping people come to grips with an inconvenient truth. There are reasons why God is to be feared, as Isaiah says, and one reason among many is the fact that he is the ultimate master over the spiritual powers at work in the world, whether for creative or destructive purposes. That's not something we should be taking lightly or ignoring. Likewise, we need to let go of our own autonomy and lordship over our own little worlds and recognize God as the King of Kings enthroned in heaven.
Speaking of enthronement, you mentioned Psalm 29 a moment ago, and we were talking about that last season with relation to the language of the flood. I remember you saying that the word that is translated as flood in the biblical flood story only appears in one other place in the whole Bible, which is Psalm 29. Does that Psalm give us any information about these seven spirits of God?
I'm glad you asked because actually it does. You see, Psalm 29 doesn't just give God the glory for being sovereign over the divine counsel. What it actually does is it takes a variety of ancient Near Eastern gods and makes a mockery of them by putting the God of Israel in their place and giving him the glory that the pagans had given these lesser gods. Specifically, we're talking about Era, Nergal, Reshef, and Baal. Now, all of these are underworld gods, and depending on the particular culture you might be talking about at the time, these could actually be co-identified as the same entity. That's going to vary from place to place and time to time. Of course, they'll never be identified with the biblical God. But the point is, they were all said to have these seven divine weapons, and in particular, for the purposes of Psalm 29, we would be looking at Baal and his seven thunders. As it turns out, when you read Psalm 29, you will find the phrase, the voice of the Lord, seven times, which can be translated as the thunder of Yahweh. I'm going to give you a quote here from an enthronement ritual text that was discovered at Ugarit. This is from text RS24.245. Baal sits enthroned, having the mountain as a throne. Hadad the shepherd like the flood in the midst of his mountain. The god of Zaphon in the midst of the mountain of victory. Seven lightnings and eight storehouses of thunder. The tree of lightning he creates. So if you read Psalm 29 while you're thinking about that, you'll see what's going on there. The biblical author has rejected Baal and given Yahweh the credit for this mastery over the cosmos. So what we've got here is these seven thunders that are alluded to in the parallelism found in that Ugaritic text and which are listed one by one in Psalm 29. Now, where have we seen the seven thunders before? Oh yeah, that's Revelation chapter 10. From verse 1, then I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven wrapped in a cloud, with a rainbow over his head, and his face was like the sun, and his legs like pillars of fire. He had a little scroll open in his hand, and he set his right foot on the sea, and his left foot on the land, and called out with a loud voice like a lion roaring. When he called out, the seven thunders sounded. And when the seven thunders had sounded, I was about to write, but I heard a voice from heaven saying, seal up what the seven thunders have said, and do not write it down. By the way, that comes right after Revelation 9 in the mention of Apollyon, the destroyer, also known as Era, Nurgle, Reshef, Baal. You getting the idea?
Wow, there is a lot going on there and a lot of connections to stuff that many Bible readers will be familiar with. So I guess this idea of the seven spirits of God shouldn't be as strange as it seems. But just to be clear, we are saying that the God of the Bible is the real power in charge of them and not the evil gods of the pagans, right? So they have to do what God wants.
Yeah, that's right, mate.
And these are the forces at work in the flood story, why the Bible calls them the waters of the flood. And our first clue to all of this was looking at the dates in the flood story and connecting them with the descent of the constellation of the seven stars of the Pleiades below the horizon, which would have happened on those dates from the perspective of somebody living in the time of the exile in Babylon. That reminds me of that part in Revelation 9, since you just mentioned it, about the star falling from heaven, which was given the key to the bottomless pit.
You're really getting this now, mate. As I said before, once you start to see this stuff, it's everywhere. So anyway, we've been talking about all this stuff to give you a bit of an idea of what it was that Noah and his family so desperately needed to escape from. It's not just thunder and lightning and rain. We're talking about the end of the world, wrath of God stuff.
But you said before that Noah and his family were protected by the atonement that Noah performed on the ark. So why did they have to be worried about the destroying angels outside the ark?
Well, as we're going to see in a forthcoming episode when we talk about the Exodus, having a bit of paint on a bit of wood over your head isn't enough to be spared from the destroyer unless you are safely tucked away inside and continuing to obey the commandment of God. You've got to follow all the instructions.
Fair enough. This flood story is starting to sound more and more like the Exodus and also like the book of Revelation at the same time.
It's almost like they're connected. Anyway, let's get back to Genesis 7 because we still have a bit of reading to do. From verse 8, of clean animals and of animals that are not clean and of birds, and of everything that creeps on the ground, two and two, male and female, went into the ark with Noah, as God had commanded Noah. Since we were talking about the Exodus, and I'm inclined to think about the mixed multitude that came out of Egypt, we notice here that the description of the different kinds of animals that were brought onto the ark seems to have become somewhat broader since the idea was first introduced. The animals are simply referred to more correctly as beasts from the Hebrew behemah, and now we have the creeping things that move on the land as well. I think the best way to think about that is perhaps the expansion of the mercy of God for any and all creatures who were willing to accept the offer of grace and get on board with Noah. And again, that's something we're going to see in the Exodus. I've already made comment on the language of male and female, but I think for me, the most significant thing about verse 9 here is the first explicit reference to the animals as two and two, or two by two, if you like. That is language borrowed from the Epic of Atrahasis. And I've already mentioned this enough times, so I'm sure you know that I'm not one of those people who believes that the Bible is a rip-off of other ancient Near Eastern stories. But if you've heard a story often enough, and you want people to think about that story when you talk to them, then you're going to borrow phrases and ideas that tie back directly to your point of reference, and this is what that looks like. So that's what we saw back when we were looking at different flood traditions, and we read portions of Irving Finkel's translation of the Ark Tablet. And it's there in the text, the flood hero receiving the instruction to bring the animals two and two. And the intent in that story, as it is here in the biblical account, is the preservation of life. We must remember that the flood story is not only about the death of the wicked, but the deliverance of the faithful.
All right. Well, that sounds like a pretty good place to wrap it up for this week. What are we doing next week?
Next time, we're going to be looking at later Jewish traditions around this idea of the destroying angels that participated in the work of God in the flood story.
That'll be interesting for sure. And speaking of interesting things, apart from you and I as well, let's do some Q&A.
I want to hear your giant questions. If you have a question about stuff you've heard on the show or somewhere else, something you found in your Bible, or just some general feedback you'd like to tell us and the world at large, here's how you do it. Head to the website, giantanswers.com. I personally receive all your mail, and I will try to get to all of it. I love hearing from you, especially if I can help you get answers to your giant questions.
Jonathan asked in the Fallen Angels and Nephilim group on Facebook, where are the Grigori? Are they in a level of heaven or in the abyss? Is the abyss Tartarus? The Fallen also mated with women. Are they instantly imprisoned after they mate? If the Fallen Third is a fixed number, when they need as many in rank to battle Yahweh's armies, do you think they risk making Nephilim after Christ? Will they make them before, that is in preparation, for the apocalypse? Whew.
Wow, that's not a question. That's like a Trojan horse of questions, but I think we can pick them off without too much difficulty. Let's start with the first one. Where are the Grigori? Okay, so for those who don't know, the Grigori, otherwise known as the Watchers, the Anunnaki, or the Sons of God, are divine beings who appropriated a human-like form for the purpose of interacting physically with human women. We're not told in the Bible how many of them defected from allegiance with God. However, in 1 Enoch, they are described as 200 in number. The chances are that's a symbolic number, so actual numbers may vary. It's hard to say if any at all remain loyal to God, because we would need to be able to disambiguate between certain archangels that are mentioned in biblical and extra-biblical Jewish texts and the Watchers themselves, and it's possible that there may be a degree of overlap there. I'm only mentioning that because there may be more than one realm in which these Grigori are in residence, but assuming that we're talking about the fallen angels of Jewish and Christian tradition, then we're talking about a place that St. Peter refers to as Tartarus. At 2 Peter 2, verse 4, in your translation you might have hell or something like that. There aren't actually many good places in the Bible for the word hell to actually be used, but that's the power of tradition, I guess. That name Tartarus comes to us courtesy of Greek tradition, where it was believed to be as far below Hades as heaven is above earth. And that's basically a paraphrase from Homer's Iliad, where Zeus describes the location of Tartarus. That's a description with some pedigree, since it comes from the 8th century BC. Most people are familiar with that use of Tartarus in 2 Peter, but there'd be less people aware of the fact that Tartarus is also mentioned in the Old Testament, in particular in the book of Job, where it appears in chapters 40 and 41, but you're only going to see that if you're reading the Septuagint. Job 40, verses 19 to 20. This is the chief of what the Lord created, made to be mocked at by his angels, but when it went up on a steep mountain, it brought gladness to the wild beasts in Tartarus. Job 41. Verses 23 to 24. It makes the deep boil like a cauldron and regards the sea as a pot of ointment and Tartarus of the deep as a captive. So that's an interesting one, because you have to regard the behemoth of Job 40 and the Leviathan of chapter 41 as being somewhat unbothered by the prospect of Tartarus, which in itself was considered a fate worse than death for even the titans of Greek mythology. You see, Tartarus was thought of as the place where these divine or perhaps semi-divine beings received their due punishment. And that's why St. Peter says that the angels that sinned were held in chains of darkness there, awaiting the judgment. Now that leads us to our next question, which is that the same as the abyss? When we read the word Tartarus, should we be thinking about the abyss, or is it something else? I think the way to tackle that is, once again, with a degree of overlap in consideration, because there's a sense in which the realm of Tartarus is most certainly considered equivalent with the abyss, but then there are also many contexts in which the abyss would not be thought of as a place where punishments are administered. The abyss is often thought of as a kind of place of banishment. Like Tartarus, there were certain divine or semi-divine beings that were considered to inhabit the abyss. There were chaos monsters and that kind of thing, and in later traditions we find that demons were sent there to await judgment, and you have that instance where demons begged Jesus not to send them into the abyss. That's in Luke chapter 8. Again, there's a fair degree of overlap, but occasionally you will find unique distinctives that will require either Tartarus or the abyss. But for all intents and purposes, you could consider them practically equivalent. In the New Testament, St. Peter talks about Tartarus. St. Paul talks about the abyss. And both of them talk about the Lord Jesus Christ descending there after his crucifixion before the resurrection. So I think that whatever they both had in mind could be considered the same thing. Moving on to another one of the questions in this Trojan horse, what happens to the fallen angels when they mate with human women? Do they get immediately imprisoned? Well, I don't think so. That certainly isn't explicitly stated in any text that I'm aware of. We know that it does happen, but it doesn't say when. But my money would be on the flood event, and for anyone who's been following this podcast over the last few months and listening to the way that I've been talking about the waters of the flood as agents of God's divine wrath and judgment, it would make sense that these guys are going to take on those fallen angels and defeat them and have them locked up. And I'll be talking more about that next week, so stick around for that. Now, getting to the last part of the question concerning the one-third of the fallen angels, I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume that this is a reference to the one-third of the stars swept out of the sky by the tail of the dragon and cast down to earth in Revelation chapter 12. In the context of that passage, this is an event that occurred at the time of the advent of Christ. If that's the case, then it follows that Michael and his angels defeated them soundly and cast Satan out of heaven at the same time, and they continue to be defeated by the blood of the Lamb and the testimony of the saints. As for the Nephilim, in my book, I make a case that the fallen angels have now lost the ability to be physically manifest in such a way as to allow them to have offspring like they did in the days of Noah. And that's a direct result of the action taken against them in the flood event, We haven't got the time to go into that here, but I have addressed that elsewhere, including previous episodes of the podcast. But the book would be the go-to resource on that. Basically, it comes down to that distinction between different kinds of bodies and their power. Now, you might be thinking about Revelation chapter 9 and the locust-like creatures that come up out of the abyss in that passage. I don't think those are giants, but I do think they are a continuation, if you like, of the original Nephilim in a newly embodied form. Basically, on my view, the Nephilim changed over time from the original giants to the Rephaim after the flood and the demons after that. What form they ultimately take in Revelation 9 is going to depend on your interpretation of that, but I have speculated that it may have something to do with the rise of transhumanism, so I think that's something to watch out for in the future.
Ooh, crazy stuff, man. All right, well, I think that's all we have time for today. Hopefully that knocked a few questions on the head for you, Jonathan. Thanks, as always, for sending that in. And as Tim said, the best thing you could do to get more of your giant questions answered would be to grab a copy of the book, Answers to Giant Questions, which you can find on Amazon or just head to the website, giantanswers.com.
That's right. And don't forget to come back next week for our episode, which is going to focus on traditions that bring out the story of the flood as we've been telling it here on the podcast.
Yeah, it's going to be a good one for sure. See you next week.
See you then.
It's time to wrap up today's episode. But if you want more, don't forget to get yourself a copy of Answers to Giant Questions. We're asking readers to please leave a review of the book on Amazon or Goodreads to help it become more visible in search results. Even if you just give it stars, that'll help. But a full review is certainly really appreciated. Please also leave a review of this podcast wherever you found us so that new listeners can find us here on the show. This podcast comes out every week, but you want to make sure you never miss an episode. So if you haven't already subscribed, do that now, and you'll get notified when each new episode drops. We'll catch you next time on the Answers to Giant Questions podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Answers to Giant Questions podcast, a production of the Raven Creek Social Club. If you like what you heard today, please take a moment to rate or review the show. Music supplied under copyright by Great Forsaken, greatforsaken.com. You can get the book Answers to Giant Questions by TJ Stedman on Amazon in paperback and Kindle format. Check out the other podcasts at ravencreeksc.com and go to giantanswers.com for more answers to giant questions. Read the blog and catch us on the socials. Don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends about the show. Send us your giant questions and stay tuned to this podcast to get answers. We'll see you next time. Until then, stay safe and God bless. Well, you know, the thing about COVID is if you don't test for it, you haven't got it.
Exactly.
Friday went to the footy. The footy was terrible. One commentator said that the Dockers' kicking was so bad that they couldn't hit the water at the beach. That was a bit embarrassing, especially since I took my boss, who's a Swans supporter, to the game. So his team flogged ours, and I was right there next to him for the duration, somewhat regretting the choice to take up my dad on his offer of a hard ginger beer, which was something like 8.3% alcohol in a can, which made me feel like I'd had half a dozen pints. So that was unfortunate.
I mean, I'm sure back in the day that wouldn't phase you at all, but you don't drink much these days, I assume.
Well, at least I'd like to have the memory of half a dozen pints to thank for the state that I'd be in after. Like, just drinking a can of this stuff, and it tasted horrible. I said to Dad, like, I've got to be honest about this. I said, this stuff tastes like someone got a glass of vodka and decided to aerate it with a can of Mortine. It was dreadful.
More for your dad then.
Well, see, he didn't like it either. Like, he bought a six-pack, right, and then he was trying to get rid of it. So he was like, oh, you know, try this, see if you like it.
Gotcha.
And I was like, hey, if I'm going to suffer through this can, you're going to suffer too. So he had one as well. And we both hated it.
Wow, what a lovely bonding experience.
Yeah, well, you know, it was about Mother's Day and mothers enjoying themselves. And, you know, Dad and I just had to
suffer,
basically invert that for our own purposes. So, yeah, mm-hmm. We suffered while they
rejoiced.
Well, you know, with the more responsible parents. I suppose we best get on with it. So I've run out of eggnog. Notice that the language of commandment occurs twice in our reading today in verses 7 and 9. The second time it says 7? 5. We try that again. We can't underestimate how valuable the early Christian missionaries were in this country.
Yeah, absolutely.
And my granddad was one of them. Went out sort of Kalgoorlie way, but like way out in the desert. He stayed with people out there and gave him the gospel. And, yeah, he learned their language and he spoke in in their language to them and, you know, lived among them.
Wow.
Which I thought was, yeah, really admirable.
So I can understand why you wouldn't want to try and recap. Why you wouldn't want to try and recap over all of that stuff.
Yeah, another thing to keep in mind about a verse like that is that it functions very much in the same way. The Bible's no dogs barking outside. Now, I won't be going over the peculiarities. I'm going to say that again. Wow, did you see some of the typos that came out in that last paragraph?
Yeah, I was wondering what bicycle on my view. I was thinking, it's funny. That good pivoting.